Hello and welcome to Warp Factor Unknown, the podcast where we delve into the world of Star Trek for an unpredictable rewatch and discussion. I'm your host Dan, and joining me today, who's just crawled out of a Jefferies tube, Tom.
Hello, lovely to be here as usual.
Fantastic. And also, on assignment from the Temporal Investigations Department, Madeline.
Hi, happy to be back.
Good, good, good. Fantastic. Good to have you both. Mads, yeah, you're here as our guest. Normally when we have a guest on, we like to have a chat with you and about you and Star Trek. But you're a returning guest, so we haven't got to do that. If anybody would like to hear about Madeline and her relationship to Star Trek, you can go back and listen to episode 5 from season 1, I think it was. It was talking about TNG. But yeah, we're not going to do that today. We're just going to sort of jump right into it. Unless anything you want to bring up, Mads, if you want to sort of say and shout out to yourself.
Oh, shout out to myself. Not really. Improvements from last time, so I'm finally up to date with Strange New Worlds, and I did finally finish Discovery.
Oh yes, you did. Mm-hmm. We had a good chat about that, didn't we, the other week? It would have been good if we had a Discovery episode to talk about today, but we don't.
I have a lot to say.
Today, we are actually watching a movie, the first movie on Warp Factor Unknown, and it is Star Trek Beyond from the Kelvin timeline. Not what me and Tom was calling on the end of our last episode, Star Trek Beyond Darkness. yeah, total amateur hour here. but you know, Beyond Darkness. Hopefully, nobody watched Star Trek Into Darkness and got confused. But you know, if that happened, I guess we're sorry. But before we kick off and actually start talking about Star Trek Beyond, we need to do a recap, and we're going to pass you over to Tom.
Mm. Star Trek Beyond follows a USS Enterprise crew halfway through their 5-year mission of deep space exploration. Captain James T. Kirk is feeling unfulfilled and considering a desk job, while Spock grapples with his identity and duty following the death of Ambassador Spock. The Enterprise docks at the advanced Yorktown Space Station for supplies and a brief rest. While there, the Enterprise receives a distress call from a stranded ship in an uncharted nebula. Kirk and crew answer the call, only to be ambushed by a swarm of alien ships led by alien Krull, who destroys the Enterprise. The crew is forced to abandon ship and crash lands on the planet Altimid, scattered and vulnerable. Krull captures most of the crew and seeks a powerful ancient artifact called the Abranath, which he intends to use as a bioweapon to destroy the Federation, which he views as hypocritical and weak. Kirk, Spock, Bones and Scotty, along with a fierce and resourceful alien named Jayla, regroup and devise a plan to stop him. Using Jayla's scavenged technology, they find an old Starfleet ship, the USS Franklin, and work together to repair and pilot it. In a climactic sequence, Kirk and the crew fly the Franklin into Yorktown to intercept Krull's bioweapon attack. They disrupt Krull's ship swarm with loud, distracting music, disorienting the attackers. Kirk confronts Krull, discovering that he was once a Starfleet captain who became embittered and transformed under the planet's energy-draining technology. With quick thinking, Kirk stops Krull, saves Yorktown, and the Federation is safe. Afterwards, Kirk finds renewed purpose, and the crew resolves to continue their mission. The film ends with the construction of a new Enterprise as the crew heads back into space.
Excellent. Fantastic. That was great. Thank you, Tom. That was quite a long recap, but it was obviously a two-hour movie.
But I thought it was you could always edit it if it's any extraneous.
Oh, no. That was good. Okay, now, obviously, as always, I have a bunch of notes, as I always bring. So I might just kick us off a little bit, and then we can sort of see how this goes. So I would like to start us chatting about, if that's okay with you guys, just kind of like generally about these movies as a whole, this Kelvin timeline, as it's called. Sort of about like kind of like the how it's designed and how it looks. So like from like the I've got my notes here, like, you know, I really like the look of this Enterprise. It's very sleek, and it does feel very sort of 2010, 2009, whatever, when that first movie came out. And I really like the sound effects in these movies. They use like a consistent, like, particular beeping in the space, and like the sound effects when the ship is going through warp. I really like that. And they use the same like main theme soundtrack for movies. And I really kind of like the whole package of how these movies look. How about you guys? Do you guys like that kind of stuff? Or do you like, actually, no, it's Enterprise. It looks like absolute balls.
Look, I'm never going to be someone that notices the visuals and the sound firstly. And that is probably quite obvious since I don't mind some of the older Trek. And I also didn't get blown away by the newer Trek with the visuals and the sound and the sets and the costumes. But having said that, now that you've described it to me, recollecting, it's like, oh, yeah, they're actually very tight in terms of design. And it is pleasing to watch, and it is pleasing to listen to. So, yes, thank you for bringing that to my attention.
You're welcome. yeah. Yeah, I kind of just, as you say, like, I like how they have that consistency through the three movies, which they do in all the other ones too, like the TNG movies and the original series movies. They have a consistent look and feel. But yeah, I got into Star Trek from the 2009 movie, so I guess I have a bit of a nostalgia, especially for that soundtrack, the main, like, the dramatic theme tune. Yeah, I really like that. The other thing I wanted to sort of, like, start off is sort of about, like, what these movies do and what they have done is, these movies aren't without criticism, as nothing ever is, but some of the big criticism that came up with the first movie and the second movie, so Star Trek and Star Trek Into Darkness, they both had a couple of scenes which have been viewed as, like, you know, pretty sexist. In the first movie, they had that scene where Kirk was hiding under, I think it's Uhura's bed, while he's been making out with some alien, and then Uhura walks in and she's getting changed, and it's just like a scene just to have two women in their underwear, and then sexy Kirk pops out. And then in the second movie, there's a scene with, I forget her name, a doctor, a scientist on board, and they're on a shuttlecraft, and she gets changed in the shuttlecraft.
Yes.
And she's just there in her underwear. And it was in all, like, I think it was in the trailer, and it was in, like, the promotional material. And it just, again, needlessly having this quite sexy scene for no real reason.
Yes.
This movie doesn't do that. There isn't, I didn't capture any, like, stupidly obvious, why are we having naked people scene. So I like that. Props to this movie for not continuing that.
Yeah, they got straight down to business. In this
franchise. They did.
Yeah.
No frolicking. Yeah. But that actually, I was thinking about this. This movie had very little downtime or rec time. I know that in the beginning you can see all the officers get off when they go have their shore leave, and there's some hugs and there's some implied partying, but it's it. Most of this movie is the action.
Yeah.
So no time for sexy time.
No. But they still could, you know, they could have easily thrown in, like, a stupid scene like that at some point in the movie.
But they chose not to, which is great.
They chose, that is great. So props to that movie in, when did this come out? Like, 2018?
2016.
Yeah, props to a 2016 movie for not being sexist. Unlike the 2009 movie, which was.
Yes. Yeah. Incidentally, that's my favourite of the trilogy.
Yeah, mine too, actually. I think if I had to, I mean, we'll probably give it to the end, but if we had to rank them, I would go first one, third one, second one.
Really?
I actually loved the Khan.
I know
OG Khan is very special to a lot of people. And I'm not going to make comments on the casting, but just in terms of the story, I found it to be really gripping. I mean, I understood the story from Khan himself, but I liked how they portrayed the series of events and put in topics like eugenics to a potentially new audience that hasn't seen the older Star Trek. So I don't want to go off on a tangent, but that is personally my favourite.
Tom, what's your sort of, like, quick rankings of those three movies?
My ranking would definitely be one first. I just thought it was great, and then two. And then this one.
Interesting.
1, 2, 3.
Yeah. So for me, Mads, like, I quite like the second movie, but it is the Khan thing. Like, particularly the casting around Benedict.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
I think that was a point in his career when he was getting a lot of big roles, and he was coming up in basically every other big movie. That over those few years.
Yes.
So I think I was a bit tired of seeing him around.
Yeah.
And also, I don't think he's not Khan. And yeah, I'm not going to go into, like, other little bits and bobs about the movie I didn't like, but I did do some bits I really liked about it. I remember rightly, I really liked the scene where they have to fly through space in their little spacesuits and they're whizzing about debris and stuff. That was a cool scene. I remember that. Anyway, we're not talking about that movie. We're talking about this movie.
The fact that neither of us selected Star Trek Beyond as our favourite one doesn't bode well for this podcast.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about, I suppose.
What is it? It's that third child energy.
Yeah.
So let's start with the opening. The with Kirk doing that bit of diplomacy with those tiny alien things.
Mm.
I liked it. Well, okay. I liked it, and then I didn't like it. I thought it was really funny, and I really liked the gag of like him saying, "Here's this peace offering," and they're like, "Why don't they want it?
Did they steal it?
I thought that was really funny. And then when it turned out that they were actually really small, again, that was funny. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's then, uniquely. Like, I'm so sorry to interrupt. I feel like it's a uniquely Kirk moment too.
Yes.
When I think of other starship captains doing some sort of first contact or doing some sort of peace treaty, I don't see those captains coming in so ill prepared. Like, can you think of Michael Burnham doing something like that? Picard?
Yeah. Oh, no.
Picard, no.
It's such a Kirk thing. Oh, maybe an Archer thing, too. And then just getting frustrated, which I love. I love the frustration.
My note here is he didn't do his homework.
Mm.
That's exactly it. Yeah, he didn't. And that's kind of what annoyed me a little bit, actually. Well, not so much Kirk not doing his homework. As you say, that's a Kirk thing to do. I get that. That's fine. It kind of fits his character. I didn't like what happened afterwards. They beam him out.
With the
thing. And
things.
Then they leave.
Yeah.
With the thing that they keep the gift and they leave this diplomatic situation hotter and more volatile than it was before. Mm. They've made it worse and then they just leave. And I was like that.
But that echoes back to...
I hate that.
correct me if I'm wrong, but the second movie where they also land on a planet, I think it's beautifully, I can't remember, is it people dressed in red clothing or something? But their first contact goes wrong and they have to break the first contact rules to rescue someone. But that is another moment where, am I getting that wrong?
No, you're completely correct. It is aliens on the planet red and it was, they're saving Spock.
Yes. So there's a pattern here, is what I'm trying to say.
Mm.
Yeah, but I feel like the difference between those two is that on the second movie, they were actually trying to save somebody. And also, they were trying to stop a volcano from blowing up and killing the aliens. Whereas this one is just, they're trying to facilitate a conversation, diplomatic relations. And Kirk is, because he's so ill-prepared, screws it up and then doesn't try and fix it.
Yeah.
If this was a TV show, one of the Star Trek shows, they would then spend the next 45 minutes... resolving that issue.
And it's a shame because they've got Uhura, they've got Spock. You know, it's not that they don't have intelligent people that can come up with some sort of diplomatic fix, so to speak. But whatever.
I think the whole film should have been about that, really, shouldn't it, really? Just like solving that 2-hour diplomatic resolution.
With the tiny aliens.
Yeah.
Okay, now, unless anyone wants to bring anything else up now, I will happily go and start talking about characters and stuff. But if anyone wants to bring anything else up before... This is like one of my bigger chats of the day, so if you want to...
If you're interested in talking about characters, I think it's probably... I've got in my notes... Yeah, having a conversation about, I guess, Kirk's journey and basically his entire character arc, this movie. Because that is... credit to the movie, it brings it up, you know, within the first 5 minutes, really, his struggles and what's going on through his head. So I don't know if you want to talk about that first.
Yeah, no, please, if you want to carry on with that train of thought of yours, and I'll piggyback off you.
So of course, as Tom mentioned, the recap, you know, it's been a 5-year mission halfway through, halfway through, and I liked the bit where he's describing the fatigue, which I think is completely understandable, and the monotony, boredom, but also how some people fare better than others, but he's not one of those people. And so then he goes, speaks with the Admiral and inquires about a promotion. And As soon as I was watching this, I immediately thought back to, now this might be a surprise to you, but my favorite Star Trek movie, my favorite, is actually Star Trek Generations.
Oh.
And that might not be anyone's first choice.
Unorthodox.
But this brought me back to the conversation.
Before you carry on, I just want to make a very quick note, is that for quite a while in my early like Star Trek fan days, Generations was actually my favourite movie. It no longer is, but it used to be. Mm. I still really like it.
Okay, great.
So, but sorry, carry on.
So I remember, is it Kirk and Picard having multiple conversations about, I guess, the forks in the road, and Kirk being much older and wiser and more reflective is giving advice to Picard about choosing what you love, choosing what you're good at, and choosing your crew, choosing your ship. And I loved that so much. And so for this to be brought up even in the Kelvin universe, in this movie, it tells me that this is something that Kirk must wrestle with throughout his life, even in the Kelvin universe.
That is fascinating. And I'm so glad you spoke first. Because I have basically the exact same conversation, but different. I also thought of that Generations movie, and I also thought back to that conversation with Picard and Kirk, and it was, I think it was in like the Nexus thing, and Kirk says to Picard, like, don't let him promote you. Don't let him move your ship. It's like, when you're in that seat, you can make a difference. Like, the speech is something along that line.
Yeah. Because
in the older movies, Kirk gets promoted to Admiral, doesn't like it, and kind of Kirks his way back into being captain, because he wants to be captain. And that is kind of my biggest complaint with this movie, is that I don't like what they did with Kirk. I don't like how they portrayed Kirk as being bored in this monotony of his five-year mission. I agree with you, Matt. I like how the movie did that, how they portrayed it. If they're going to show a character going through that journey, they did it really well. I just don't think that's Kirk's journey, or shouldn't be Kirk's journey.
Please. I just wanted to ask, do you think, I know what you mean, but the way I see Kirk is that he's an action, like Sisko or like Archer, he's an action, what I call an action captain. And is this, and I was going to bring this up later on, is the term five-year mission is thrown around a lot in Star Trek. And I find myself a little bit confused because I think I've been imagining a different five-year mission. I thought, and I promise this is relevant, I thought a five-year mission is you steer the starship away from Federation space and you go in somewhat of a straight line. Or maybe like you do a loop, like 2.5 years kind of in this direction, and then you kind of start doing this circle back. That's what I thought it was. So I thought you were doing, you know, exploring strange new worlds.
Yeah, no, that is exactly correct.
Okay, so why is he so bored?
Well, okay, yes, and the five-year mission is what happens in like the Star Trek original series show. That's years 1, 2, 3, and
also Strange New Worlds.
And Strange New Worlds, yeah, it's like what they do, but they obviously sometimes loop back, and they're always going back to the star bases and stuff and Earth. So it's in a straight line until it's not. It's kind of not very clear on what that is. But you're right. Kirk shouldn't be bored. And that's kind of my point, is that, yeah, Kirk has a few big character traits, like the action captain. He wants to be involved. And like when me and Tom spoke about original series, we noted that whenever there's a fight, Kirk is the first one there throwing punches. He's in the thick of it. Another one, I would say one of Kirk's biggest character traits is his desire for command and his obsession with being in the chair. When Kirk is not in the captain's chair, that's all he wants. That's where he wants to be. And we see this in these movies. In the first movie, it takes a little bit of wrangling, but like, you know, that old Spock says to Kirk, like, you must be the captain. You're in charge. And like, it's kind of Kirk's destiny to be the captain.
Yeah.
So seeing him in this movie
as the captain,
not want to be as the captain, he's got what he wants and he's doing what he wants. This should be Kirk as Kirk should be. Like, I like that Kirk is struggling. I don't like why he's struggling, if that makes sense.
I just, maybe I can imagine him being put on a 2-year science mission where he has to defer to Spock and the other science crew and nothing ever happens. Okay, sure, I could imagine that being frustrating for him. But a 5-year mission of unknown worlds, new civilizations, mysteries, action. Yeah, this should be his jam. So, yeah, it's just a thought. That's why I brought up the 5-year mission, because that was the only thing I could think of that was bothering him.
The 5-year mission, I know this is a different universe, but it's also kind of the same, similar things happen. We have, like, Khan and stuff. Like, so the things that happened in the original series should also be kind of happening in Davis Kirk. Like, he should be seeing a giant Abraham Lincoln in space, and he should be wrestling with Apollo, and, you know, all these other fantastical things that happened in the original series should still have happened in some form, so it doesn't make sense that Kirk is bored. If they had said, like, oh, in that bit where he was monologuing and sort of saying how it is monotonous, he said, we're on a 5-year mission, we're in year 3, but for the past 12 months, all we've done is diplomacy. All we've done is, like, cargo runs.
Yeah.
And, like, he feels like the mission is sort of, like, lost its focus. And I can see that.
Mm. And then, finally, on reflection, this movie has a lot of action. He saves the day again. And then he says, oh, no, to the Admiral, actually, I will stay on as captain. Mm. So it felt very much like a solve. Oh, he's just not had an opportunity to do a punch-up in a while. Mm. He has. Now he's good for another 2 years. It was very shallow.
Yeah, 100%. And because I kind of felt like when they got... So they went to Yorktown, and then they got this distress call, go to the nebula, sort of thing. And when that was happening, and when they'd gone through a nebula and they got attacked by a swarm, and I actually thought the swarm attack scene was fantastic.
Oh,
it looked cool. Amazing. It sounded cool. So exciting. A lot of fun. I loved it. Again, I didn't like Kirk. That's really frustrating. Again, so Kirk's on the bridge, and the ship has been crippled. The nacelles have gone, can't go to warp. And in my mind, at that point, the ship is doomed. Like, any reasonable captain would go, this is a really bad spot. Yet Kirk, sort of watching him, the character, be performed, it almost feels like he doesn't want to be on the brick. He's not very engaged in the combat and the scenario going on, and he's almost looking for an excuse to get off the bridge. And the second that Krall comes onto the ship, he's off, he's gone, and he leaves the bridge in command of Sulu. It's not even like Spock's there. Spock's also gone. And I was kind of like, that's not what a captain should do. The ship needs him on the bridge, not going to punch up some guy.
Picard wouldn't have done that.
No, or Sisko wouldn't. Like, at no point in that engagement, that fight, did I feel that Kirk was being Kirk.
I may be wrong, but isn't there an element that Red Alert is kind of implied that the bridge is, I'm not going to say sealed off, but in a way sealed off? Like, I've seen it before where, not security guards, but am I barking up the wrong tree? I just thought, it's very much implied that when you're in Red Alert, you're in the bridge.
That's normally my impression too. Like, I think it's a bit inconsistent between the shows and the movies and different episodes and stuff. But,
you're right. Like, I can't imagine Red another Alert captain. And Sulu did fantastic. He did what he could with a completely decimated ship.
Yeah. I want to keep us on the character portrayal. It does kind of link back to what we're talking about, Spock, and I really want to come back later on. I want to come back to more of these, like, action scenes and, like, how cool, like, the swarm scene was and the rest of it. But I want to stay with the character conversation for a bit, and I want to talk about Spock and how much I thought Spock's character portrayal was so much better than Kirk's. Spock wanting to leave the Enterprise makes complete sense.
Yes.
He's had this, you know, this crisis of faith with Admiral Spock dying, and also with Vulcan being destroyed. He's now kind of like an endangered species. I can see the tug and the pull of why he would want to leave the Enterprise and go to New Vulcan. And I think it's great. I think that is a much better way of showing how this character would want to leave Starfleet.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is also I can understand the breakup between him and Uhura. You know, the first time you hear it, you go, oh, wow, okay, so you've chosen to break up the love of your life because you might have to marry a Vulcan woman and reproduce your species. It sounds very cold, but on reflection, you look at him and you look at the pain in his half-Vulcan, half-human face, and as much as it's cruel, it also completely makes sense to me. That need to do everything that he can to help New Vulcan and to continue Ambassador Spock's legacy. And that also means potentially having an arranged marriage and having children and not with the woman that you love. And props to Uhura, unlike the second movie where they're all having their, you know, argy-bargy stuff, she seems to have taken it really well.
Yeah, she's not happy about it, but she I think at least understands. And not that we should be rewriting these movies, but if I was in the writer's room and having these conversations about character arcs, and let's say the producers or the director or somebody wanted, like, we need to have Kirk have a crisis of faith and maybe he's questioning his command. I think a better way of doing that for this movie would be have Spock quite early in the movie tell Kirk he's leaving. And then Kirk, his crisis is he feels like he can't command the Enterprise without Spock. And maybe there's a reason why Bones also wants to leave. So, like, he's now losing his two best friends and his two, like, the people he relies on to command the ship. And he's like, I can't do this. He basically rabbit in headlights jumps and, like, goes and tries to get promotion that way. And that would have been better than
I'm bored. I think that would be a better resolution. Like, your friends are leaving. That's a better reason to leave.
I mean, yeah, because, like, then it could have been, like, they have that conversation, they have that crisis, and then the ship gets ashore, then they get split up, and then they spend a good portion of the movie with Kirk struggling with that and trying to resolve that on his own without being able to talk to Spock. And Spock is also dealing with that in his adventure with Bones. And then when they come back, they basically almost resolved it between themselves individually, and they come back and they cry and they hug. It's amazing. Oh, you know, flowers and all that stuff.
And it's we've had so much development of their relationship through the first two movies, from, you know, almost enemies really, into deep friendship in the second one, deep friendship. And this third one, this is their opportunity to show an audience what a deep friendship is, professional, but also a wonderful masculine friendship. And not once do they tell each other about these fears, these concerns, you know, these nightmares that they're having, this boredom, whatever it is, they're not telling each other. So what was the point of showing us that the relationship development?
So Kirk
can't go through life only talking to Bones, because Bones only has one way of dealing with emotions. And he's great. I love him.
Yeah. Bones' solution is to steal a junior officer's whiskey out of his locker.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't just get drunk and solve your problems. So I feel like that was a waste opportunity of those two characters not speaking.
I think that's a really good point. I completely agree on that one. Love it. Good stuff.
Without jumping to the ending, I suppose tying up Spock's decision. Because as we've already complained that Kirk's decision to stay on as captain felt a bit because it seemed like he was chasing action, though I know they meant to say, oh, he loves his family, he loves his ship. But Spock's, I think, was very unspoken, and using props like that beautiful photo of the OG crew in their uniforms on the original Enterprise, and the music, and his emotions on his face. Like, that was more powerful to me. You know, he knows that he's one day going to take up Ambassador Spock's mantle. One day he will be ambassador of, you know, on New Vulcan. But it's not today.
He's got time.
He has stuff to do. And this work that he does on the Enterprise is meaningful. And his crewmates mean the world to him, and hopefully it's implied that Uhura is also incredibly special to him. So I thought that was a nice way of tying it up, and I felt quite satisfied with his decision to stay on the Enterprise.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. Like, maybe they could have did a bit more telling of that as opposed to just sort of showing of that, but yeah, otherwise you're right. It's compared to Kirk's like resolution, it was a bit more solid, a bit more grounded.
I actually have a question for you, Tom.
Oh, please.
Because when I watch things with you, whether it's Star Trek or any other piece of media, you have this wonderful knack for pointing out the obvious. And I mean that it's great. We have great laughter and great conversations about it. I would like to know your thoughts about the giant, undefended glass bubble in space housing millions and millions of people in an unknown location. Please correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it is somewhere near the Earth system or New Vulcan.
Yeah.
Can you please tell me how you, when you first saw that, how did you feel?
It does seem to have a design flaw in that it's in space, miles away from anywhere, and undefended. Yeah, I thought there was definitely... I'm actually stretched because I'm reading through the Star Trek Beyond Alpha fandom thing at the moment. And I just realised there's no Earth in this at all. There's no mention of Earth. There's no any scenes taking place on Earth, which is good. As for the glass bubble, yeah, it seemed a bit of a weird design location. A bit of a weird place to have a glass bubble. You'd think you'd defend it better.
Especially if it's just newly opened.
Yeah.
Yes. Look, and I actually found it quite funny how Bones actually raised an eyebrow at it. And then they kind of looked at him like, oh, yeah, well, you know, it's fine.
Mm.
And no, it was absolutely not fine.
No.
I'm with Bones on this one 100%.
Your eyebrow
that
raised.
Thing is a monstrosity. Yeah, like, so, Roger pointed out, it's massive. It's humongous.
Millions of people.
The biggest space station we've seen in all of Star Trek. And I thought it was too big. For what it was, like an outpost station.
Yes, key word, outpost. Mm.
Who are these millions of people moving to the frontier? Like, DS9 was on the frontier and it had, like, what, a couple hundred people?
yeah.
You know what I mean?
How many does this hold?
Who's
How
moving there?
How many does this actually hold?
I know they said millions.
Oh, there are skyscrapers. It is...
Multiple layers of skyscrapers.
It was weird. And also, it's a glass bubble with lots of empty space inside.
Mm.
But that's not where the spaceships come into dock. Mm. They go through like little tunnels. So all that space inside is kind of wasted, which is all is also like pressurized with like gravity and oxygen and stuff. So they're maintaining a large portion of space.
I guess that's their like atmosphere.
I'm so frustrated now. And I just want to say, in case anyone's actually listening, I'm not assuming it's glass. It could be some amazing material that's very, very strong.
Look,
that's all well
and good. Glass.
It's space glass.
Space glass.
Like from Star Trek 4.
Unlike Deep Space Nine, there's no planet, there's no wormhole, there's no moon, there's nothing to look at. So why have you made it out of space glass? Like, it doesn't make sense.
And why is it visible? Because you'd think, I don't know, like DS9 had...
Oh, paint it black.
Yeah, exactly.
No one will see.
At least more of a space theme, put stars on it or something. But it just stands out.
Yeah.
Sorry.
As a target, like a big marble.
Sorry, Mads. Would you have a better opinion of it if it had a nicer view? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I can understand having windows if you have something to look at.
Mm.
Spaceships have windows because occasionally they go past things. And it's nice to see out and good for crew morale. But if millions of people are living here and the space station doesn't move and there's nothing to look at, I do not see a point.
There is that really big, scary, ominous nebula just nearby.
Maybe they can change the theme.
Well, nearby, but it's not in view to the eyeball.
Mm.
Maybe if Legolas was there and he had his elf eyes.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm just ranting because I just feel like it's far too advanced for even the Kelvin timeline Enterprise, OG.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, even in Discovery 900 years in the future, they have nice space stations. They're like swirly whirly ones, but they're not all made of glass. Space glass.
Mm. Yeah, I thought it was a bit too big. And it was almost like, oh, you need to have millions of people to raise the stakes. And like, mm-hmm. I don't think you do.
They could have just replaced it with a planet.
Yeah, it was almost like they wanted to have this cool, like they'd written and they designed the ending fight scene, and they had to like build something around that.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. I don't know. I actually have quite a few almost like play-by-play notes on the when the Enterprise gets destroyed, scene as the swarm scene.
I want to talk about that.
Yeah, that's good.
Do one of you guys want to start? And I'm reading through my notes. It's almost like I'm nitpicking it, even though I thought it was one of the best scenes in the movie. But no, you want one of you guys start about that scene?
Tom, you go, Tom.
Well, I thought it was really good. The fact that I thought the special effects in this whole film were fantastic, right from you know, the almost like Inception like cityscape. I love that. I know we're talking about something different, but you know when they're in the city and you see the skyscrapers and they're looking up and they can see like different level of skyscrapers and angle. Well, the effects that were that amazing sort of carried on to the destruction of the Enterprise as well. And yeah, I thought it was a really good scene when it crash landed saucer first into the planet. You really felt it. I thought the sort of destruction effects were just great. Mad, you could do a much more.
Sorry, when you say. Sorry, no, Tom. I want to pick a point. When you said the saucer crashed, and you said you really felt it. Can you expand on that a second?
Yeah, just how well done it was, special effect wise. You know, sometimes it just feels like this is like CGI. It's fake. But this felt more real than that. Just the way they did it, and the sound effects and everything all merged into one.
I thought you meant because one of my last. Nitpicks about that scene was actually about the Enterprise crashing, and because you used the word feel
emotionally,
emotion,
not physically.
No, one of my niggles was that we've seen the Enterprise and other starships crash and blow up before, and whenever that happens, it's always like quite an emotional, almost a gut punch, because in Star Trek, the ship is always it's kind of like another member of the crew,
same character.
We always have like an emotional attachment to that ship. When this ship went down, I didn't feel it. I didn't feel that emotional hit, and I don't feel like the characters were also as put out by it as I've seen in other movies, if that makes sense. They weren't as... It's almost like they didn't feel the loss as much. Especially, it goes back to like Kirk as well, because Kirk wasn't feeling his command.
Probably.
I didn't feel like that emotional attachment between him and his ship
was more
strong
as when... going on.
Oh, that's it. That's an interesting point that you raised, that because Kirk wasn't, he wasn't 100% there. Yeah.
Mm, true. And I guess that sort of affects how everyone else feels about the film. If he's not in it, if the captain's not in it, the crew and also the viewers are not going to be in it as much.
Okay, yeah, sorry to interrupt. So, Madge, would you want to take us on your journey of the swarm attack scene?
I have thoughts. Mm. So, I agree. It is, in terms of a starship being absolutely decimated, this is probably the best scene I've ever witnessed. Mm. It was just brutal. It was like the ship was just getting garrotted. The warp core gone. The nacelles sliced. Like huge, huge bits of hull being ripped off with crewmates being pulled out. They did such a good job of showing how the strongest, the fastest, the best ship in the fleet in a matter of maybe 15-20 minutes can be completely just broken into pieces. So I admit the scene is phenomenal. I don't know why Kirk left the bridge, but it was great. And even the jettisoning of the escape pods were great. But I have a bigger gripe, and this is more like a Kelvin trilogy gripe. And I don't want to be annoying, but I hate the mass loss of life that we see in these films. And maybe we're all getting numb to it because action films, science fiction films have a lot of city destroying or planet destroying, whatever. And there's always mass casualties. Maybe we're getting used to it, but that wasn't something that I got used to in Star Trek.
Mm.
And people died. Of course people died in Star Trek. There could be diseases going through. There was obviously, like, the Dominion War was horrible. obviously death and war and destruction happens in Star Trek. I know that. But in these three movies, it is just relentless. You know, the loss of Vulcan. Oh my God, really? We had to lose a planet? Like, really? And so in this one, it's just awful. Like, I get that I get for the story they wanted to tell, the Enterprise had to crash land. And it had to be I get that. But just seeing dozens and dozens of Starfleet officers and crewmen being jettisoned out. There was a scene where one of the attackers, either Crawl or one of his attackers, used a gun and it killed four people in a row and they fell like sacks of potatoes. It's just distressing. And what I hate even more is that the escape pods go. And at that time, I'm thinking it's the bridge crew and maybe some people in like the middle bit of the ship. Like maybe not so much the civilians, but you know, maybe the people in the middle because they've been a little bit protected. They just got to get to the escape pods. No, you get the scenes on the planet where it looks like there's 300 people. So don't, and that's a cop out to me. Don't show me like all these people getting killed and swathes of the ship being torn apart. And I can use my imagination. I assume the oxygen was gone. And then go, no, it's all right. We actually only lost about 6 or 7 people. And they'll be remembered. Thanks for your sacrifice. Look at all these hundreds of crewmen. And that means Kirk doesn't have to feel guilty. Starfleet doesn't have to feel guilty about sending in one ship through a dangerous nebula on some sort of bequest of a really shady female alien with a distress call. Like, it's just, they get to wipe their hands of it. Oh, it's just the ship and, like, maybe a couple of people that died. Anyway, sorry, that's my rant.
That was amazing. That was great.
I do have an additional point, actually, about the destruction of the Enterprise, based on what Matt said. I forgot about the drones, you know, the things that attack the ship. What are they called again? The Swarm. And
but basically drones. I think you're right.
When I was thinking about the destruction of the Enterprise, I was thinking about when it actually crash-landed saucer first into the planet. The drone scene for me was one of the best scenes of the film. I thought it was fantastic, as you said, Matt, as well. Like the way it was swirling and actually the death and destruction that happened, I thought actually enhanced that scene even more because, to me, it's kind of like it made it more like, oh, this is serious. If it just showed like the Swarm,
I understand,
lightly tapping people and like grazing their shoulders, I probably wouldn't have felt, you know, that was such an amazing scene. But the fact it was actually sucking them out into space and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
To me, it enhanced it. But you're right, though. In typical Star Trek, you don't see that. I guess maybe it's implied, but you don't see the death and destruction like you do in this film. And to me, it felt like a bit like Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, when what's that scene where Groot, he shoots out his tentacle arm and it like spears 10 people in a row, and then he like hits them side to side across the corridor of the ship. It's like wow, he's killed 10 people, but it's also a funny scene.
Absolutely. And those kind of movies, I have really, and that's probably the desensitization. Mm. I have no problem with that kind of very colorful action. Everyone is, I mean, we don't know those people. They were probably bad people. We don't care about them. Like, we just care about our superheroes. But going back to what you and Dan were talking about before, about how the ship is almost another character, maybe that's me also feeling like the crew is that other character.
Yeah.
And so maybe I'm just getting a bit too emotional about it. But watching it, I can see why a movie like Guardians of the Galaxy or any other action film, Star Wars, oh my God, how many planets has Star Wars destroyed? Billions. Gosh, billions of people have died there. That doesn't feel the same. But when it's Star Trek,
it's different.
And it's a planet or it's a city, yeah, it hits different.
Yeah, I suppose. So true.
That's great. I kind of want to come down somewhere in the middle of you two, like Madeline. Yeah, I did feel that the amount of crew that was lost on the ship was a lot more than the film later revealed and then sort of like reflected on. But then also, Tom, with you, like, I'm going to say quite as cavalier as your approach on it, but I think that when the nacelles got cut, In my mind, like the nacelles will have some crew up there. Maybe not like loads of crews, like a few engineers doing maintenance or whatever. Like there are Jeffrey's tubes and stuff. So in my mind, when the nacelles got cut, I think that should have been the biggest loss of life. Maybe there was like 30 crew up there. And that could have been, you know, on the bridge or between Kirk and Scotty. Like, we've lost ourselves. Like, and Scotty could have gone, I've lost my crew. I've lost my crew, yeah.
Yeah. And I like, lost my best men down there.
Yeah, something like that. That could have been like the really big emotional, this is serious, we've lost people, as opposed to, holy shit, like, you know, half the crew has been ejected into space. Because, yeah, a movie needs high stakes. And I think death of crew is part. But yes, Matt, you're 100% right. They just keep left, right, and center quite cavalier of how much they kill people.
I just thought one more thing, and I'm going to try and wrap this up in a positive.
Yeah.
is great respect to the engineering of the Enterprise. It's lost warp. The nacelles were gone, but yet they were still trying to get a little bit of impulse. And then they crashed. They safely crashed, I suppose, because of Uhura and Kirk having a bit of a fight with Kroll and etc. But the fact that the saucer section survived, I don't even know how fast it's going, re-entry, slicing through rocks and mountains and crash landing in the most violent way. And it was still, like, okay.
Mm.
Now, what they did later in the movie really effed it up, but extraordinary. Extraordinary that that ship survived.
I want to piggyback off that comment. Okay, so Madge, 100% right. I'm gonna gush over that bit there. So at this point, the Enterprise has had its deflector dish knocked out. The nacelles have gone, and the entire star drive section of the ship has been cut off, and the ship is crashing to the planet. It's hurtling down. There's tons of damage to the ship. The ship is gone. It's dead. There's even if it stayed in space, I would be surprised if they could salvage it and, you know, repair it. I think it is gone. But around that time in the scene, I think it's Chekhov says to Kirk or says to someone that the hull integrity is at 18%. And on my first watch, I was like, wait, that's actually a lot higher than I thought it would be. I think 18% is pretty low, but the ship is done. I actually thought 18% was quite high, given the context. I thought he would have said, hull integrity is gone. It's gone, sir. It's gone, as Chekhov says. So I was amazed that it was still at 18%, because half the ship had gone.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say they're so lucky they crash-landed on an oxygen-rich planet. Because I'm not so sure if life support was...
Classic Star Trek. There's always an M-class planet nearby.
But, yeah, it was... I know what you mean, both of you, when you kind of say that the crash of the death of a starship is a gut punch.
Yeah.
But it was also really nice to see it trying its hardest. And I know I'm putting a personality into it. But when it finally kind of crashed, it still, like, I don't know, it just still looked like it. It wasn't just rubble.
I also didn't realize that the Enterprise... that Enterprise had the ability to separate its saucer. I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't realize. I thought that was cool.
That's always cool, Dan.
Yeah, but they have this epic ability which they never use. Okay, I'm still on the scene. I've actually got. It appears most of my notes are on this bloody swarm scene. When they first start engaging the swarm, they shoot the lasers, the phasers, and they don't really do much. And they shoot the torpedoes, which just go straight through. And they say, oh no, they have no effect. And I thought, well, just have it so that the torpedoes detonate.
Yeah, like, set a timer.
Set a timer and have like an area of effect kind of attack. And I was nitpicking. I'm nitpicking. okay, and also in that bit, the ship starts getting attacked and the swarm first hit the ship and some of the hull comes off and like the shields are useless and all this kind of stuff. And this happens a few times in Star Trek. Bones is just stood there on the bridge. And I'm like, you should be sprinting to the sick bay. What are you doing? Yeah. He stood there for quite a while before he goes down to sick bay. Again, I'm nitpicking.
But this is the common complaint that well, not a complaint, because we love to see our characters together on the bridge interacting. They often explain it away, you know, old Geordi can be, Geordi can do everything he needs to do from
the bridge.
On the bridge. He's got an engineering platform. Oh, Spock, well, he can do everything that he needs to do over here. It's just, it's like a multi-tool. But yeah, it was full on to see Scotty, who is, again, to describe an engineer, he's, I feel like he's a very thick of it, hands, like physical kind of engineer. Mm. It was unusual to not have him actually in engineering. And yeah, Bones, there may have been one or two medical emergencies that he may have needed.
Scraps and bruises. But I thought Scotty was an engineer. He was down below.
Oh, yes. I'm so sorry. Cut that out.
Yeah. We like to keep
on. No, I don't want to be mistaken.
No.
That's right. He was helping people. He helped one person. No, he didn't. He looked at one person who was still alive, got horrified by their face and went, ugh. And then the person died.
That's technically help, I suppose.
Kind of, you know, pronounced someone dead. Okay, I have one last little thing about the swarm scene, and that is I really like Scotty's impromptu escape via a torpedo.
Mm.
That's such a Scotty thing to do, to just like improvise away. It's like, I'm going to make this work. No, but it was really fun. Quite like that. And especially I like the bit at the end when he actually lands on the planet and he does that. It's such a movie thing to do. He has to jump off and he grabs the cliff.
It was exciting. As you guys know, I do indoor rock climbing. Do you know how hard, how impossibly hard that is? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how many hours this man spends in the gym doing pull-ups, so maybe he's absolutely ripped. I don't know.
Whenever a movie has a character holding on something up high from one hand, I'm
like, no, not happening. Dead. It's not happening.
But it's always fun. Oh, I have one more. Sorry, I've got more. I am moving past the swarm scene, but we're still like in the early part of the movie. When Kirk and Chekhov have that, their escape pod kind of goes together. On the bridge, on the ship, they're in their normal uniform, the gold uniform. But then when they land and get their escape pod, they're in this like combat kind of uniform. And I was kind of confused where Kirk got changed into his combat.
Don't ask questions.
It was probably under his other uniform, and he just stripped that one off really quickly and was ready for combat.
And underneath that is the dress uniform.
Yeah, a little skirt.
Oh. Yeah, I have no comment.
Yeah.
No, there is no comment. Just like, I was like, when we do this podcast, you have to point out stupid things for no reason.
What I would like, I don't know where you're going with this, but speaking of Chekhov and Kirk, I really enjoyed the character pair-offs this movie.
Oh, yes,
I really enjoyed Kirk and Chekhov.
Mm-hmm.
I felt, now I don't think it was very well developed, but I could sense that kind of, you know, mentor captain vibe, younger eager officer. I felt that. And then we had Scotty with Jayla, the alien engineer, awesome woman. And then we of course had Bones and Spock, but also for a moment, we did also have Uhura and Sulu.
Mm. Did. Yeah, I think I agree. All the pairings are great. Like Spock and Bones, it's always going to be a good combination.
Yes.
But it was also nice to see them, almost how much their actual friendship had developed beyond their sort of cheeky rivalry. They do have a lot of respect for each other. I do think that Uhura and Sulu, they get the least amount of character moments in this movie. They are definitely side characters, which is a shame because they're both really good.
I love the actors.
Are really good. But yeah, a movie can only focus on so much. I really like Scotty's thing with Jayla. I think those two work really well. Like, they're both engineers. They're both different.
Montgomery Scotty.
Montgomery Scotty. I thought she was going to say Montgomery Scott Scotty.
That would have been even better.
I thought she was.
I would have loved that.
Yeah, that would have been really fun. But let's talk about Jayla. I love Jayla. I think she's great. What a great character. Super competent, super useful, like not like movie sexualized in any kind of way. Mm-hmm. I thought that was great. I love that she'd repaired, for the most part, the Franklin. Mm. I thought that was great. And even though she had that kind of stupid, broken English alien language thing, I think it kind of worked. I don't think it was cheesy in any way. I did quite like that.
I think she was a really, she did it such a good job of portraying a young character. Because the way I feel, I feel like she gives off 18-year-old or even, yeah, maybe like 18, 20. And that's young. And that's a really young character who has spent, well, I guess, what, over a decade being stranded on this planet alone. She can completely go toe-to-toe with Scotty. An older, more social, more, you know. I felt that she was able to portray a young character well and not in an annoying way. Because let's be honest, there's a lot of young characters that do appear in Star Trek, as there should, but sometimes they rub people off the wrong way. But I think she did a great job of being young and inexperienced, but also opinionated, determined, brave. Mm. So I really liked her. She was great.
Yeah, and I like those scenes when she pushed back and she was like, oh no, I don't want to go rescue those guys. I don't want to go back to that place.
But I also like the scenes where she doesn't push back, but you can tell she wants to, because there's that youth and inexperience. And I feel for her, I feel that she is in a way manipulated and ganged up on to go and rescue these people that she doesn't know. But yes, she does push back in some ways, but I like that. I like that she's not, like this perfect, confident, amazing 18-year-old.
Mm. Yeah, and I was going to say, I like the little scene, the little section where Kirk says something and she storms out. She's like, I'm not going to do it.
Mm.
And Scotty goes to go after her and Kirk says, leave her. And because in a lot of TV and movies that happen, they will say, oh, leave that character. They need a moment themselves. But Scotty goes, no, she's just had as much pain or something as we, and he goes, Scotty, like, no, fuck you, Kirk, I'm gonna go comfort my friend. And he does, and that was the correct decision.
Yes.
She needed a friend in that moment. So yes. Screw you, Kirk, go Scotty. That was great.
Yeah, that was great. And I do like I like the way that they interact. There's a great respect between the two of them. For people that have only met maybe half an hour ago.
Exactly. Yeah.
She was probably my favourite character in this film. You know, like sometimes you watch a film and you're waiting for a character to appear in the next scene or... there's something about how she portrayed this character in this film that made me want to see her, more of her. So, yeah, I thought she was really, really good. I liked her backstory. I liked the fact she was an engineer. And I loved the makeup. Makeup was fantastic, I thought.
Oh, yeah. And I... Speaking of the Franklin, you know, I don't know about you guys, but like, oh my gosh, another Starship.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, a legacy. Well, it's not a legacy ship because I'd never heard of it. But you know, oh my gosh, from a different era. This is so exciting. Mm. And even with the mass loss of life, even Kirk is pretty kind of excited, and Scotty's excited about it. I like that she doesn't like. This is her ticket out of there. She doesn't know about Starfleet, or at least she doesn't talk about Starfleet. She doesn't know about the Franklin. She doesn't even care about the crew. Mm. So I quite like that. She's like, this is a means for me to get out. Stop fussing.
Yeah.
Stop fussing over this hunk of junk.
Oh, I was going to say, the Franklin, I was just reading up on Memory Alpha. It was actually launched between 2145 and 2151. So an early, early ship in Star Trek universe.
It's an NX class, Tom. It's the same ship. A slightly early design, but similar ship to Archer's ship. It appeared to be just before. Archer's was the first Warp 5 ship, and this is the first Warp 4 ship. Mm. Now, I have a Star Trek lore niggle about this. I'm going to...
Yeah.
So, when you watch Enterprise, the impression you get is that Earth has warp capabilities. You know, low warp, Warp 1, Warp 2 ships. And the Warp 5 ship, the Enterprise, is like, this is a big step forward, and it's taken humanity about 100 years with the pushback of the Vulcans to make this ship.
Yeah.
But now we learn there was actually a Warp 4 ship, and I'm like, oh, that kind of...
I thought the Enterprise was like
a really big step forward, but actually it was only a tiny step forward.
Well, was it made directly after, like, you know how there was that element in this movie, like, oh, there's always a spare.
Mm.
Favourite movie, Contact. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but, you know.
I have.
It's just my favourite movie ever. But, you know, a terrorist attack takes out the huge alien transportation device that cost trillions. And they're like, oh my gosh, we're devastated. And then like, don't worry, we built a spare. Mm. It's just.
I love
that's
that.
The vibes.
Yeah, right there with
me. So maybe they built the Franklin 2 months after.
Well, no, my point is like it's the Franklin was worse than the Enterprise because it's only warp 4.
Mm.
So it implies that it came before the Enterprise.
Oh yeah. Unless it was just really hard to keep doing warp 5 engines. But you know, I'm not great with star dates and I'm not a starship person, so I'll just stop talking.
It looks like it was launched in 2258, the Enterprise. So like nearly 100 years after that ship. So,
what?
Yeah. So it took them 100 years to advance one warp. I'm just looking now. So USS Franklin was built in 2145, and the USS Enterprise was 2260.
But the whole point of this movie is that the villain is like, no one came for us. And it's like, well, no one could come for you if you were the only Warp 4 ship and it took 100 years for the next one to be built.
That also doesn't make sense because at some point they were talking about Krall's backstory and they mentioned Vizindi, which Archer encounters Vizindi for the first time.
We're going to have to like just back off because this is like upsetting me.
We need to write a letter to the studio.
Yeah.
Did you know that on this star date?
Yeah. Anyway, I'm always happy to have some sort of legacy or some sort of like older mystery starship that pops up. It reminds me, I'm so sorry for this tangent, reminds me of my, that's embarrassing. One of my top 5 episodes of TNG, The Royale.
Yes.
Because if you remember, but they find this old, like, I'm not going to say Apollo era, but like actual space era.
Astronaut era.
Thank you so much. And I just got so excited. And it ended up being the best episode ever. So yeah, it's always exciting to get some sort of historical piece of Starfleet, you know, or Federation.
I would also like to tangent on like an episode of TNG, which also calls back. For all its faults, because it has got some faults, the episode where they bring Scotty back and with the Dyson Sphere.
Oh, I love the Dyson Sphere. But not
and
the
then
episode.
Scotty goes on. Yeah, then when Scotty goes on to like, the old Enterprise bridge and like they reboot the set.
Yeah,
oh,
that's
love
beautiful.
It. Yeah, I love when Star Trek does.
Talking of spares, as we just were, like spare ships, and all that, brought to mind like Contact. You know, when they have that big spinny whirly thing that transports them to it.
But I just said
that. Oh, did you? Maybe that's why I thought about it. So,
what the hell has happened?
The audio is cutting out. I'm sorry. So I imagined you said that. I don't know. Anyway, but maybe edit that bit out, Dan. Just to
I think I will actually. Tom, as you were saying that, as you was leading up to your used arms, bring up to my spare parts. I was like, he's not. Is
I can't believe it.
No, he is. He's. And then you said Contact. I was like, fucking hell. That's amazing. You should have seen the smile get bigger on my face.
So I say that first, and then like mad is like.
Oh yeah, and then she's like, oh Contact, yes.
Then
yeah,
I can be
yeah,
like, yeah. I can edit this bit. Oh, I just said that, man. I look smart now.
Yeah, that's really fun. I have the smallest, tiniest niggle. And I think it's when I noticed it, I was like, "Dan, that's just such an idiot. That's so stupid." But I've got to bring it up. Okay, on the Franklin again. Okay, so the Franklin is an NX class ship. So even though we've apparently discovered there's some weird 100-year time difference between the Franklin and the Enterprise, in my mind, it's basically the same ship, like another version of the Enterprise, the NX class. On the Enterprise, the NX-01, so Archer's Enterprise, the helm position is manned by Mayweather. And he sits, if you're sitting in the captain's chair, you're facing the view screen, he sits on the right, on the right-hand side of a captain. But in the Franklin, Sulu is sat on the left. And I think that is because on the original series Enterprise and in this Enterprise, Sulu sits on the left. So I just think they're like, oh, Sulu has to sit on the left. That's where Sulu sits. Except on this ship, he should be sat on the right because that's where the helm is. And it really bugged me.
On a level of 1 to 10, how much did it bug you?
it didn't like bug me to like take me out of the movie or anything like that, but it was more, it wasn't quite like annoying. It's more like, Dan, why do you notice that? Why? I have a problem. Yeah, that's kind of what did it for me. Crawl, the bad guy, Idris Elba.
Yes.
I thought it was crap.
Yep.
It was awful. Yeah. It was
really. What a waste of the actor.
Yeah, as a character, he didn't have any, his motivation sucked.
Yeah.
He just like generic bad guy with generic bad guy story and generic bad guy intentions. He's like, oh, I feel sad, so I'm going to go kill a bunch of people. Like, he was a soldier and he doesn't want peace. Oh my God. Like, come on, do better. It's so boring. Yeah. And like,
I agree.
And it's not even like, sorry, I want one more sentence. He wants to bring the Federation back to hardship, but not by starting another war like what he experienced, but just by committing mass murder. Grumble. Sorry, Matt, go.
No, I agree. And that's why, I know it sounds like we were nitpicking, but that's why I kind of wanted to know when he was captain. What was he experiencing? Because, yeah, the Zindi's mentioned and the war is mentioned, and I get that, and he might have that classic, you know, Wolf 359, whatever it is, trauma. But, you know, and then they do a little bit of character research on him, background research. Okay, so he's in the military. That's pretty expected because, I mean, they hadn't really made the Federation. They hadn't really established Starfleet. So it made sense to put a military commander in charge of a spaceship. That's fine. But, yeah, you're right. It's like, where did this... Do you have problems with Starfleet or do you have problems with Earth? Like, you went off into the nebula, you got stranded, your crew died, you ate them, I don't know. You have all this fury inside you. And so you're right. Like, okay, so what? You're going to go to the nearest starbase and just kill everybody. But, like, what's deeper than that? Like, what do you... like, is it actually Starfleet?
What are your motivations?
Or is it the you know?
When they revealed him to be human, I was like, ah, oh, I wish they'd have kept him as the monster he was to start with, you know, and just keep him like that and have alien reasons for what he did, but transforming into what he was just seemed a bit shallow. And I don't know.
There was actually, I just realized this, if he really was, again, depending on when he was placed, if he really does remember the warfare, from his time, it would have been great to have moments where maybe he, depending on the timeline, maybe sees a Romulan or maybe sees a Vulcan and has that kind of archer attitude in season one or season two, which is, I hate your guts. Or maybe, I'm not saying there'd be someone from the Zindi, but there could have been an interaction where he rages and kills a crewman or something violently because of that. But his only interaction...
in the prison camp.
Yeah, but his only interaction really is with humans and then a couple of unidentifiable crewmen that I don't know what they are. I don't know. I just don't know what his problem... exactly what you're saying. What is his problem?
Yeah, the bad guys in this movie are a bit crap, actually. And on a light note, like I thought that the henchmen, when they were in their full uniforms with their helmets on, I thought they look like the bad guys from Galaxy Quest.
Oh, yeah.
They gave me that vibe.
That takes the seriousness out of it.
A little. But also, what the hell is... who are these henchmen?
I had to Google it.
Okay. Okay, I didn't. And I'm going to... So I'm going to, like... It's my uninformed brain, and you can tell me what they actually are. But here's what I... So, on the Franklin logs, Kroll says, or Edison says, there's him and three of a crew. There's four of them left. But then and then at most, the Franklin would have had, 150 crew? I think the Enterprise NX Archer's one had about 150. So, but the Swarm has thousands of ships, and they're not robots because we see not once, but twice, Kirk and Spock and Bones go inside one of them, and there are guys in there, and they eject them into space. Mm. So unless they got very lucky and just happened to go into the one to have guys in, they're not drones. They're not robots. I don't get it.
Yeah, so I had to, I don't know if you Googled Tom, but I had to Google it because in the, in his logs, he's like, everyone has died apart from, I think, a couple of people. I think in the end, you have him and you have two main henchmen. And then I had to Google, like, okay, so it looks like there's been lots of crash landings on this planet. It's such an unlucky planet. But, and that makes sense because Jayla's family... looks like she came on quite a large ship, so maybe a lot of people got captured. So maybe a few large ships got captured. But, like, that's three people. So you're saying, like, three people collectively started rounding up the survivors, and I don't know if they've got alien technology that can manipulate them or whatever. And then, yeah, you're right, all of a sudden we've got thousands of people. Like, I know it's been 200 years, but how many crash landings are you having?
And they all want to destroy Starfleet? What is this?
Yeah, that's the thing. So either he's got some sort of mind control thing, and also he has to eat them. Also, not eat them, but he has to, like, him and his two henchmen, they have to absorb people occasionally to have longer life. So, yeah, you've got a population problem, just like New Vulcan, you know?
Was it explained in your research what actually happened?
Yeah, they just say crash landed.
Why?
I didn't look up if it was mind control because why would I do research for a podcast?
true. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of all I had on, like, the bad guys, because they weren't really anything special. No. I didn't. They were kind of like the worst part of the movie, the bad guys. Okay. At the end, the gravity plaza thing is so stupid. Like, they have the center of the space globe thing, the Yorktown, and they have three super high skyscrapers, which if you jump off the top, you then end up floating. That seems really dangerous. I don't know why anyone would. I don't get it. It's really stupid.
Well, yes, and it's also the Star Wars vibes. Like, there's a hole, and there's something that we need to protect in the hole, and so we just fly in.
I quite like the bit where, like, the Enterprise shoots up from the water and, like, splats the Krall ship. I thought that was quite fun. I enjoyed that. And I love the little police shuttles. That was so
fun. Useless.
Useless. Like, didn't do nothing. But I liked that they were there, but they didn't do anything.
So, I'm going back to Krall, our favourite character, the villain. So he crash lands with his two henchmen, and they eat people and they live a bit. They discover this completely unnamed, uninvestigated alien technology that seems incredibly advanced. It can give you your life back, but also there's all these squillions of drones. They realize there's the Abernath.
Yeah.
Okay, so, like, oh my god, wow, bioweapon, this is so exciting. And then they talk about having this amazing, like, communications system, or at least a spy system, so he can use the drones to go out, and they've been able to watch Yorktown, hack into Yorktown, and hack into the Enterprise. So if he discovered that technology very early on, why didn't he just escape the nebula? Why didn't he send a communique? True. And then why go to so much effort to getting that stupid bioweapon when we could see that the drones could just overpower the space station anyway?
They're way more effective.
Like, if they had been watching the comms, let Enterprise come in, they get their supplies, they fly out, and then attack. And then there's no space, there's no spaceships, completely decimate it, and then save your bioweapon for a planet.
Yeah, the plot doesn't really make sense. Like, I know I had some big complaints about Kirk earlier, but the strength of this movie is more on the characters as opposed to the plot. The plot doesn't really make sense when you analyze it like we're doing.
Yeah.
No. And I'd say it's not the bad characters either, when we focus on the characters, because they were naff. It's basically Jayla to me. And then everyone else wasn't as good. I don't know why. Fair. She was like the highlight of the film.
Yeah, she was good.
Oh, and Scotty. I like Scotty as well.
I love the wise Admiral at the beginning.
Yeah, she was good. She's the Admiral, or she's in
The Expanse.
Expansive. Yeah, yeah.
She's excellent and frightening.
Oh, with the husky voice. She was also in 24.
Yes.
A really good season
Blast
of 24.
From the past.
Yeah, really good in that.
So we now need to give like some final thoughts, a little quick review of it, and then give it an IMDb rating.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to go first?
I will go first, if that's all right with everyone.
Yeah, please, take it away.
I thought this film, as we just discussed, it's got fantastic characters, with sort of Jayla and Montgomery Scott being the best to me. The other ones, there's a few plot holes, or quite a few plot holes, I would say, in basically their motives. And I also didn't like the fact that Kirk's sort of despondency of how he was feeling about Federation sort of was rectified. But apart from that, I absolutely loved the special effects. I thought they were great. The swarm attack, I really enjoyed that sort of the skyscraper sort of station where you look up and you see like skyscrapers above you and everything. I love that. It reminded me of Inception, sort of the callbacks to that. I did enjoy the film, but it is certainly not my favorite of the trilogy. And definitely not Star Trek films as a whole.
And if you had to give it an IMDb rating?
I'm going to give it a low one. I'm going to give it a 6.2, which for me is quite low.
Yeah, that is pretty low. That is fine. That is good. I think I'm going to mostly echo what you said. I enjoyed the movie. It was a lot of fun. I liked all the action sequences, and it visually a very good movie. For the most part, I liked all the characters. I had my issues with Kirk in this movie, but everyone else, you know, I thought was really good. I enjoyed the Spock and Bones scenes and Scotty and Jayla. They're all great. And yeah, as we've been chatting, the plot doesn't really make sense. It doesn't really have to. So Star Trek movie doesn't need to make sense. You just need to have your characters do cool character things. But yeah, so I liked it. Didn't love it. I still think I've obviously not watched the other two movies in quite a while, but right now I would say I think I still prefer this one over Into Darkness, I think. But if I was to rewatch them one in one go, that would change. Anyway, so for an IMDb, yeah, I think I might go like a 6.5. like, I liked
That's
it
quite,
I,
yeah.
I, it's still quite low. I did like it, but I don't know when I would want to next rewatch this. It'd probably be a while. I think, whereas like, you know, after I watch First Contact, I can pretty confidently say that, oh yeah, within the next like year or so, I'll probably want to rewatch that again. So yeah, that's what I'm going to say. 6.5.
Yeah.
Mads?
Yeah. I mean, you've said it all. Look, I know that probably sounds like I've been quite critical, but overall, it was an enjoyable watch. And what I'll say about the JJ Star Trek movies is that they do capture your attention. It's like just this sugar rush. Lots of action, some jokes, amazing special effects. So, and I don't have the best attention span. So the fact is I was able to watch it in one go without looking at my phone. That's actually really good. And so I will give it credit. One thing I wish they had done, which, and again, might speak to why I like the second one more, and maybe even the first one more a bit, is that while they have no obligation to do this, I feel like when you remaster a show with legacy characters, but not the legacy actors, I feel like this is your chance to maybe retell a story, like with Khan, with your own spin on it, or progress your characters, or put them through something that you maybe wish they could go through in the original series or TNG or whatever, but were limited because it was a TV show or whatever. I hope that makes sense. But in the second one, I felt like we got it. In the first one, we got backstory of Kirk and all the other characters, which was nice. But in this one, again, not to gripe on about Kirk's growth or lack of, but it's like you've kind of just given us an episode and raised the stakes with a bit of ship destroying. But it just felt like a normal episode. It didn't feel like it was, we're going to take something really exciting from the original series, the Prime Universe, and we're going to like throw it at them this way. Let's see how they respond. So, yeah, I would have liked a little bit more big Star Trek story instead of just a, I don't know, save the day kind of thing. But yeah, that's my thoughts. But I actually liked it, I think, more than you guys. So I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
Cool. Very nice. Excellent. Yeah, good. Nice. Actually, that's something we didn't actually touch on at all the movies. The casting. I think every actor who's portraying an original character, I think, kills it.
Yeah.
Chris Pine, Zoe Saldana, Simon Pegg, they all nail it. They're great. Carl Urban is Bones. Yes. Fantastic cast. Mm-hmm. They all play the characters really well. I don't think there's any character which
I have no casting complaints.
Misdone. No, they're all great.
I'm the same.
I just wanted more. If you have such great actors that were doing such a good job portraying these characters, then give them more.
Well, okay, fantastic. Right, what did it actually get on IMDb? It got Star Trek Beyond. Gets a 7 on the dot. Well done, Madge. You got it. Well done.
Wow.
Great. Nice. Yeah, I think that's about right. Actually, I think that's fair. Like, the movie's fine. It's good. It's great. It's not amazing. It's just. It's a Star Trek movie.
And probably not a bad, I mean, not that someone would necessarily watch this first as their first Star Trek, but it's not a bad entry into the series.
No.
It might give someone a false belief that there's a lot of action in every episode. But then I think I remember I told you guys my first introduction to Star Trek when I was younger was Nemesis. So there's no right or wrong way of getting into Star Trek.
No, there is not.
Mine was First Contact.
First Contact is so strong,
That's actually good.
Yeah. I remember watching it thinking, who are these people?
Yeah, because, like, First Contact is good because we know so much about Picard and his relationship with the Borg. So I wonder how much that would impact you not knowing any of that stuff.
And Nemesis with, like, I don't know, like with the Romulans data, and stuff.
Yeah,
and
like so data much lore you need
and you
to
don't,
know. Yeah.
And you don't understand, like, I remember, and I was like a teenager. Like, I remember, like, oh my god, this is awful. I like Data; he's so cool. I'd only just met him, but I didn't understand how brutal that was to people who were actually watching it then. Whereas I was like, oh, this is a nice movie. Why did the nice robot man have to die?
He has such good humor.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and he had his emotion.
Yeah, he did,
early,
yeah.
Right?
But yeah.
Oh, he did, didn't he? Yeah,
yeah. So then I went back to Next Gen, first episode, so clunky. And I'm like, oh, why is he very, data-like?
God, his acting's improved in the two films, yeah.
You know what? Now I have a massive urge to watch Generations.
Yeah.
And Insurrection.
Okay, so what we're not going to do now is we're not going to choose another episode to watch because this is episode 10, end of season.
Oh, but I'll
put my randomizer away.
I know. But what we will do, me and Tom are going to catch up at some point and we're going to do like a little recap of season 2, sort of like we did for the beginning of the season. We did like a season 2 introduction. We'll do a little chat post out. We haven't actually discussed if we're doing season 3, but it'll possibly, maybe, we'll see. We'll let you know. If we do, it'll be called Season 3 Introduction. If we don't, it'll be called Season 2 Recap. But yeah, me and Tom, we're going to have that conversation. So if we are going to do Season 3, we'll do an episode selection there. So watch out for that. But one thing we have got to do, Tom, is we have got to do our character selection. Mads, I don't think if you've sort of caught up. When we had Sasant on our podcast, he started us by saying, if you could choose a member of crew for your fantasy ship, who would you choose? So every episode since then, me and Tom have been slowly building a fantasy crew. I know. So we've done quite a few. We've done our first officers, we've done engineering, tactical, we've done counselor, and we've done generic ensign. Oh, Tom, who did we do last time for Strange New Worlds?
We did.
It was science. We did science officer.
Science officer, that's right.
I chose 7 of 9. I think you chose.
Oh, I chose Jax, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. Yeah. Okay. So but this time we've got to choose somebody else. So we've got left. We could do captains. We could do doctor. Do medical. We haven't done helm. We could do helm. We could do comms.
You say we haven't done captains yet?
Haven't done captains.
Should we go out with a bang?
Do that last, Captain.
Yeah, I think Captain last. Yeah. Right? Let's build the rest of the crew and then do that. So, we've got Doctor or Helm.
Doctor.
Should we go Doctor?
Doctor. Yeah, obviously, Madge, you can choose Doctor. One too. Now, I'm going to read the list, but I already know who I'm choosing. I'll like snap dunk, I know who I've got. But the list, yeah. the list I've got is Bones. But that's Bones, like original series Bones, and also the Carl Urban Bones. I don't think we have a Bones in Strange New Worlds. There's also there's Crusher, there's Pulaski, there's Bashir, there's the Doctor, there's Phlox. We have Culber from Discovery, Tiana from Lower Decks for Cat Lady. We have Mbenga from Strange New Worlds.
I love that.
Tendi from Lower Decks, Zero from Prodigy. I think that's most of them. There might be others I've missed, so if anyone else you want to throw in the mix, mm-hmm. please go ahead. But, Doctor, Madeline, give me your Doctor.
I'm going to choose Jet Reno.
Jet Reno is an engineer.
Is she, though? When you see her in Discovery, she stayed with all of the critically injured crew. And she kept them all alive. I mean,
okay.
No.
Yeah,
in all
sold.
Seriousness, no, because she would also be my engineer, and she would also be my captain, and she would also be everyone. Phlox.
Good choice.
He has knowledge of all species, so not just human centric. He's incredibly compassionate. He does science experiments on the side. He loves animals, and I say he's kind of like half counselor vibes as well, just like Culber from Discovery, and he's funny. Yeah.
Fantastic. Mm. I love your trying to shoehorn in Jet Reno, which is great.
It's phenomenal. Like if you rewatch that episode, she's got like someone's brain in a thing. People are like in wheelchairs or whatever with like limbs that have been stuck together, and then I think there's a bit where Pike or Burnham are like, oh, you like the medical, and she's like, no, I'm an engineer. Everyone jettisoned out, but she stayed. I just love her to bits.
I think I gave her like a runner-up position for engineering. I was like, if we'd seen more of her,
would absolutely be my engineer of choice. However, my only complaint of her is that she doesn't move quickly. If you look at any situation in Discovery, the ship's about to explode, the spore drive is going offline, whatever it is, you never see her running. And often, like, Stamets has to beg her to fix something. And she does. She always does. But in her time.
Fantastic. Tom, who is your Doctor?
My Doctor of choice is later season Bashir.
Love that you put that. Yeah.
Yeah. That. Not early season awkward.
Cringe.
Cringe Bashir, but later season. Probably season 3 onwards. I just think he becomes a lot more professional, less cringe, and someone you'd want sort of on your team, I would suppose.
Yeah, no, but she is great. Yeah, and if I'd answered this question a few years ago, I probably would have said like the Doctor because he's really good. But I said at the top, I know who I'm going for, snap choice, and it is it's Phlox, 100% Phlox. Kind of the same reasons you gave, Matt. He is so enthusiastic about space travel, xenobiology. He volunteered to be part of this experimental, like, exchange program. He wants to explore. He wants to, you know, we see him on Enterprise. He's constantly engaging in the human social activities, trying their food, going to movie night. He's great. I think he's fantastic. And on top of that, he's just a great doctor. He actually patch you up really well. So, yeah, Phlox. Thank you for listening into Warp Factor Unknown. I've been your host, Dan, and I've been joined by my co-host, Tom.
Lovely to have had you all listen to us this last season. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we've also been joined by a guest co-host, Madeline.
Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed talking about my favourite movie, Contact.
Fantastic. Good. Oh, I'm really glad you mentioned Contact there. Today we talked about the Star Trek movie, Star Trek Beyond, from the Kelvin timeline. join us next time when me and Tom wrap up season 2 and have a talk about what we're going to be doing in the future. And until then, thank you for your continued support. If you would like to contact us, please email us at warpfactorunknown@outlook.com. Again, it's warpfactorunknown@outlook.com. And you can leave us comments on YouTube and Spotify and wherever else. The music we use for the podcast is called Starfleet Command by Jeff Harvey. Thank you very much.